the one he couldn't ignore. He knew it was lunacy to speak to her with Miriam so wary of danger, but after a moment he found himself replying.
"Yes,"
he intoned, feeling like a fish on a hook.
"As I dreamed, you've come for me."
The voice was as faint as the wind on a cool desert night, likely due as much to Miriam's lead-lined amulet as any precautions on Rumayesh's part.
"I've not come for you."
"Have you not?"
That knowing tone of hers.
"Then why?"
"For me," he wanted to say, but it sounded weak and foolish. Just then Miriam stopped. The sapphire at her neck began to glow softly, casting the sand all around them a snowy blue. She motioned Kiral to stand across from her. Kiral did, his eyes glinting as he watched Miriam pull a stopper from an ampoule of dark liquid.
"Be careful," he said.
"Leave none of your own scent upon this summoning, or the Arek may come for you."
Miriam, her face ghastly in the pale light, nodded and tipped the ampoule over. As the liquid pattered onto the sand near her feet, Brahma felt her drawing on Rumayesh's power.
"I summon thee, Guldraven, with the blood of the one you seek."
In the silence that followed, Brahma heard Rumayesh's desperate voice.
"Come, Brahma! Do it now!"
Brahma found himself rising to a half-crouch, one hand gripping the obsidian stone in the pouch at his belt. With Miriam occupied and Kiral transfixed by the ritual unfolding before him, the urge to rise and sprint toward them was strong and growing stronger. Miriam tipped the ampoule over a second time.
"I draw you near, Guldraven, with the blood of the one you covered."
"Do you wish me to beg, Brahma? Come! You will have no better chance than this."
It was true. Miriam and Kiral stood transfixed as they stared at the sand. Yet Brahma remained where he was as Miriam emptied the ampoule. He could smell it on the wind, a bitter copper scent. Kneeling, Miriam placed her hand on the black spot on the sand. With her other, she gripped the sapphire at her neck.
"By the dark god's smile! Now! Now! Drive your knife into her back before she returns to her senses!"
The urge to charge, knife drawn, was so strong he realized he had taken a step forward only when he had heard his footfall. He could kill them both and free himself from the constant desire, the need to liberate the creature that had tortured him for months. With a force of will, he held himself still. He wasn't even sure why, not until he heard that old voice, his own, whispering to him.
"She nearly has you. If you give yourself over to her now, there will be no going back."
Ahead, Miriam's voice gained in volume and pitch until it felt as if she were screaming,
"Come, Guldraven, that you may devour Chedamin Aileshala! Come, that you may consume the heart of the White Wolf, and know that when you do, you will find Hamzakir, the one who tricked you, the one who has for so long eluded you. Thus you will satisfy your undying hunger, Guldraven. This is my debt paid. Come hither with haste, and find not one, but both."
That name.
Chedamin.
Amansir said she was in danger, a sacrifice to Guldraven, so that Miriam might have her way in all this. But Brahma hadn't really believed it until now. It had seemed too unlikely that the thread of Cheda's life would once more intertwine with his. Cheda, after all, had been the one to draw him into Rumayesh's web. She had been the one to save him from her as well, when Rumayesh would have kept him as a pet to torture him until she had found someone else and tossed him aside. It was the remembrance of all Rumayesh had done to him, the pain she had inflicted upon him. Gods, how distant it seems now! That allowed him to drive his kanshar into its sheath, to lie down on the sand and wait. For a long while, all was silence, save for the sounds coming from the line of ships.
"Is it done?" Kiral asked.
Limbs trembling, Meriem lifted herself up off the sand, but she was so weak she couldn't seem to make it onto her legs.
"Don't you stand there!"
The words were biting, but also faint, as if she had trouble voicing them. Kiral came to her side and helped her to stand.
"Is it done?"
"Yes, it's on the move. I can feel it."
"It won't arrive too soon, I hope."
"No,"
Meriem said as she dusted her hands free of the bloody sand caked on them. As the amulet began to lose its glow, she met Kiral's gaze.
"It will be afternoon, I suspect. The question now is whether his quarry will still be alive or not."
"He will," Kiral said flatly. "Anor has agreed to stand with the kings, at least until the 13th tribe has been destroyed once and for all. I'm more worried the Erek will suspect our treachery."
Meriem laughed darkly.
"As you should be. But it's done now. The fates will see to the rest."
As the two of them headed side by side toward the king's galleon, the amulet's light failed altogether, and their silhouettes played against the wavering light of the distant cook fires. Brahma waited until they were far enough away, then he stood and ran for the deeper desert. Chapter 59. Salsana dropped to the sand beside Leora, who lay unmoving after the spectacle of chasing the worm from the battlefield. Chayda ran toward them, but slowed her pace as a horn blew. Another followed. Then another. These were their own horns. Tribe Kadri's, Tribe Kianat's. Gasps followed. People pointed along the horizon, their faces filled with fear, anger, even grim acceptance, as if they'd expected something like this all along. Chayda came to a standstill and saw what the others had already seen. Ships. Royal galleons. By Tulathan's bright eyes, there were scores of them headed their way. The sound of footsteps made her turn. Sumeya was there, Melisse as well. Masid and Ishak, father and son, blooded and bruised, were beside them with Frail Lamai and Hamid and, thank the gods, Emre, trailing behind.
"Why are they slowing?"
Frail Lamai asked. Indeed, many of the ships were coming to a halt, their sails hardly billowed in a strangely deadened wind. Frail Lamai motioned to Leora.
"Did she do it?"
"No, Lamai,"
Ishak replied calmly.
"The doldrums come often enough this time of year."
"That's true," Sumeya said, "but chances are it won't last long. It could lift in the night or in the morning. When it does, the kings will attack. Best if you ready all the ships you can and set sail when it does."
Ishak took in the devastation, the hundreds moving to help the wounded onto ships.
"Look around you. I'd be surprised if half our ships could sail by morning, and of those, some will be hobbled. The kings have royal galleons and clippers. Half our number would be left to die here, and more would die as the kings took our ships at their leisure."
Sumeya's stare. Her very stance was unforgiving.
"Would it not be better if some lived?"
Ishak looked at her bitterly, as if he had expected nothing less from a blade maiden. He pointed Chayda toward Leora.
"Go.
Will you speak after the sun has set?
And then he walked with Masid toward the shade of a nearby clipper where many of the wounded were being taken. After a nod to Sumeya, an indicator that they would speak soon, Cheda rushed to Leora's side. Salsana was sprinkling water from a flask over Leora's dress and hijab. Leora's breathing was shallow, her skin deathly pale, but there was a contented smile on her lips. She seemed only to be sleeping, but responded neither to gentle shaking nor shouts for her to wake. Dard Sada soon arrived, with his ungainly medicinals bag, and began rummaging inside it. He moved slowly due to his wounded shoulder, but tended to her like a dutiful son, a strange yet welcome thing coming from a man who was so often quarrelsome. As the sun began to set, Leora was still unsteady, so they called Frail Lamai to carry her to her yacht. Dard Sada took up Nalame's staff and went with them, leaving Cheda alone with Salsana. Part of Cheda wanted to join them. She needed to know more about the staff, how Leora had come to possess it. But she was in no state to talk, and there was more Cheda needed to tend to in any case. "Will you walk with me?" Cheda asked Salsana. "I need to find Said." Salsana nodded, and the two of them fell into step. As their strides carried them over the grasping sand, it was clear that something was on Salsana's mind. She knit her brow and avoided Cheda's gaze, but she remained silent as they headed toward the site of Cheda's battle with Onor.
"Is it Karim that troubles you so?" Cheda asked.
They were nearing the place where Zaid's body had been laid out with dozens of others. Beyond them, set apart, was Karim, still lifeless.
"Yes," Salsana replied. "But..."
She looked down and pulled the golden band from her wrist, then handed it to Cheda.
"Keep this, won't you? Hear them. Their call is strong at the moment."
She accepted the weighty band.
"I will. Of course, but...
I need a bit of time, Cheda." She motioned to Zaid. "You have grieving to do. We'll speak again tonight."
"Of course, but where are you going?"
"There are those I must speak with."
She looked like she had had a revelation of some sort. Cheda wanted to demand who she wanted to speak with and why, but Salsana was already running toward the Amaranth. She seemed to have had some sort of revelation, but apparently the mystery would have to wait. She had changed greatly in the weeks Cheda had been gone. She'd been so angry when the two of them had sailed from the old tower in the desert. She'd wanted to fight Cheda. It was foolish, but Cheda took the bait, and the zeal with which Salsana had fought had revealed how deeply her anger went. Yet, as unfortunate as the skirmish had been, it had brought Salsana and Karim together. Karim had changed Salsana, shown her the truth in a way that words never could. As outwardly angry as she had been when they met, she was inwardly focused now. As Salsana had urged her, Cheda felt for the souls trapped within the bracelet. Salsana was right. They were active, and Cheda could feel their sorrow at the loss of Karim. But beyond that, she felt little change from the weeks she had worn it after killing Masut on the Night of Endless Swords. All around her, many were tending to the wounded, others to the dead. Others worked the ships, repairing them, preparing them to sail should Ishak send the call to flee. Cheda, meanwhile, slipped the golden band over her wrist and walked along the line of dead. The effects of the petal she had taken before the battle had worn off, and her wounds were fully awake. They needed tending to, but not yet. Just as she reached Zaid's body, she heard a voice call out behind her.
"Do you still think Ishak was wise to summon your tribe from hiding?"
Cheda turned as Sumeya approached.
She stopped across from Cheda on the other side of Zaid's body. Her face was unreadable. Pity? Contempt? Perhaps both.
I don't know, Cheda replied.
The very notion of being together fills me with joy, but this...
Some of the dead had been wrapped in canvas, from sails or cloth, scavenged from the black spear ships. But so many had died that not all could be covered as they deserved. Not yet, in any case. Not until the battle had been decided.
Some will die tonight, and many more tomorrow. Perhaps all of us. But Ishak was right. Had he done nothing, the kings could have killed us at their ease. Another great purge was coming one way or another.
I suppose you're right. She knelt by Zaid's side.
Cheda dropped to the sand as well and stared at Zaid's slack features, now painted in blood. She looked different, neither at peace nor in pain, a forgotten vessel while her soul walked among the farther fields.
I'm sorry, Cheda whispered.
For what? Samaya asked.
I don't know.
Cheda pulled Zaid's cowl over her head, hiding her face and ravaged neck, then took out a thread and needle and began sewing the cowl closed.
She had a difficult life.
We all have difficult lives. Our worth is measured by how we rise against adversity.
How very trite.
Not trite, Sumer replied.
True. It isn't so simple as that.
It is precisely that simple. The gods give us choices every day. They give us children when none were looked for. They take our mothers and fathers too soon. They place obstacles before all that we want, or give us our deepest desire only to reveal it was just a mirage. We don't give up our responsibility to make the right choice because the decisions are harder. It's precisely the opposite, and the harder the choice, the more our souls are tempered by it.
Cheda motioned to Zaid.
Did she choose her father?
No, but she was given choices in how to deal with him. She chose not to act every day in the House of Maidens, and she made a choice today when she threw herself against him.
Cheda stared at her.
And which was the better choice, do you think?
Sumer made a face, the one she always made when she thought Cheda was being impertinent.
If you're asking if I regret her sacrifice, of course I don't. She saved many, dozens, hundreds, perhaps my own life among them. My point is, she always had more control than she thought she did. And today, she proved it.
Cheda stared at her body.
She did more than save lives. She gave us an opportunity. If Isan's words are true, that Onur is weakened when he feasts on human flesh.
Sumer turned her gaze eastward, where Onur's ships could be seen in the distance.
Is that what you wish now? To attack Onur?
Seeing Sumer ready to bow to Cheda's will felt strange, but Cheda was grateful for it.
It is. But we should ask Ishak if he thinks it wise first.
Sumer stared open-mouthed at Cheda.
Chedamin Ayanashala, are you prepared to take counsel?
Cheda tried to hide her growing smile.
I am. By Tulafan's bright eyes.
The two of them fell into step as they walked toward Ishak's caravel. Sumer gave a toothy smile and threw an arm around Cheda's shoulders.
I never thought I'd see the day.
Well, I thought it best to try it once.
Once?
Before I die.
Sumer laughed grimly, then loudly, and the stress of the battle, the relief of still being alive, so struck Cheda that she laughed right along with her. As night fell, a fire was built. Maseed was notably absent, but the rest of the tribe's elders gathered around it to speak. Their scouts had counted 73 Royal Navy ships, and Onur had escaped with 35. An emissary had been sent to request parley with the kings, but he had been shot with a half-dozen arrows upon voicing the request. The kings were here to crush the 13th tribe. If the kings could manage to take Onur as well, they would likely do so, though the fact remained that he was one of their own. Had they invited him to join them? Would they work together to obliterate the 13th tribe and come to some arrangement afterward? Onur, the feasting king, had seemed intent on taking Sharakai down from outside its walls, but coming so near death could change a man. If the kings had made an overture, Onur may very well have had a change of heart. As was to be expected, the mood around the fire was grim. Ishak always seemed to project strength, but now the decision to summon the 13th tribe seemed to be weighing on him. No one believed they could win in a direct assault against the kings, least of all him.
"We should push on as soon as the wind returns," Shalalara said. She had a bloody bandage over one eye. "We cannot flee," Hamid replied. "If we do, they'll pick off our ships one by one and have us in the end anyway. But make as though we're preparing to run, as they'll expect, an attack at the right moment. Then perhaps we have a chance at victory."
The words sounded foolish to Cheda, and most looked despondent, but not Emre. There was a fire in him that she hadn't seen in a long while. Not since they were children. Not since before his brother, Rafa, was murdered.
"We have allies in Onur's camp," he said. "We should use them. We must use them, or we'll be abandoning them to suffer beneath Onur."
Standing by his side was a stunning Malasani beauty named Hadad, who had joined the council after Emre petitioned Ishak to allow it. For some unfathomable reason, Ishak had agreed. She had so far been silent, but she didn't have to say a word to distract Cheda. She was studying Emre as if she hung on his every word. Cheda ignored her as best she could and addressed the circle.
"Onur is the key," she said. "If we kill Onur, his warriors will fight for us. Kadri certainly will. Likely Masal as well, even if Salmuk won't."
Emre agreed.
"They'll not sit by as the kings of Sharakai come for us. Not after what Onur has done to them. Not if he's dead."
The circle parted to make room for Maseed.
"It will be more complicated than that."
He had two others in tow, men Cheda thought she might never see again, certainly not together, and certainly not here. The first was Ramad Amansir, looking thinner than she remembered, more haggard. His eyes scanned the gathering, and then, when they landed on her, he stopped, frozen, as if he regretted finding her here. Or regretted something, in any case. The other was Brahma, the thief she had recruited to help rid her of the Arek, Rumayesh. To Cheda's great regret, it had gone awry, and had led to the riddle of scars that covered nearly every square inch of his body. When their eyes met, he looked suddenly young again, fragile and fearful, as if his thoughts had returned to that time of imprisonment and torture.
"Hamzakir is with Onur now," Maseed went on.
The flickering fire made Ishak seem to waver, as if he were insubstantial.
"How do you know?"
"I saw it," Brahma cut in.
"And who are you?" Ishak shot back.
"His name is Brahma Junaidava," Cheda said, "and I trust him to tell me the truth."
Brahma gave her a sharp nod before continuing.
"Only a few hours ago, I saw Hamzakir leave Kiral's own ship, masked by a spell of the Queen of Chimera's making. When he left, he headed east and later,
when King Kiral and Queen Meriem were talking, they spoke of an accord with Onur. Together, they hope to close in on you when the wind rises.
My queen has been in league with King Kiral for months, Ramad added. They're hoping to use Onur to rid themselves of you. And perhaps of Onur, but especially Khan Zakir. Kiral considers him his greatest threat.
Ishak took Ramad in from head to toe.
And why would you betray your queen by coming to us? She tried to have me killed for defying her. She is a mage, like Khan Zakir. But she's also found a sapphire that contains an Irek, a creature Brahma and Chedamin are familiar with.
All eyes turned to Cheda. She nodded.
Years ago, with Brahma's help, I trapped the Irek named Rumayesh in a sapphire. I didn't know that Meriem now has it.
She does, Ramad went on. And the only thing stopping her from using it is another Irek, Guldraden, to whom she owes a blood debt. To whom I owe a blood debt.
Meriem plans to honor it by delivering Khan Zakir to the Irek. Ramad was staring at Cheda strangely.
What is it? She asked him. What haven't you told us?
Guldraden will come for Khan Zakir, he said. But your blood was used to summon it.
A gasp ran through the gathering. Cheda raised her hand for silence, and slowly their voices settled.
Why would it want me?
You remember when Meriem and I were in the desert?
He paused, suddenly fumbling for his words.
Get on with it.
He licked his lips.
Khan Zakir left me and Meriem in the desert as a sacrifice to Guldraden. He thought it would appease the Irek.
It took King Alduin, she said,
recalling how she had stumbled across his body in the desert, but spared you both.
Why?
I pleaded for our lives, Ramad said. I begged for more time to find Khan Zakir, and it demanded your blood.
The people around the fire faded from Cheda's consciousness. Only she and Ramad remained. A thousand things played through her mind. Foremost was the appearance of yet another Irek in her life. Rumayesh had been entranced by her, now Guldraden as well.
Why?
She asked, more to herself than Ramad.
I cannot say, Ramad answered. It seems fascinated by your tale when we first met. It knew of you even then. And when I stood before it the second time and offered my own blood as payment for our failure, it asked for yours instead.
And you agreed?
Ramad's jaw tightened, then he nodded.
I would hear it from your lips.
I was afraid, Chaitar.
He could hardly meet her eyes.
I wanted to leave that I might find Khan Zakir and rid us all of Guldraden's curse.
Say it.
I agreed, but I never thought. We'd planned to find Khan Zakir.
So you said, Cheda replied evenly.
Did you?
Ramad shook his head in shame.
I tried. We'd planned to find him by taking Brahma's stone.
Find him or protect yourselves from Guldraden's wrath, Cheda said, piecing the puzzle together. Isn't that the right of it?
He nodded.
That was Meriem's plan, yes. I only wanted to save you.
The confusion in Cheda was turning to rage.
Stop saying you wanted to protect me. You're the one who placed me in danger in the first place.
He started to protest, but Cheda spoke over him.
So now, after all you've done to protect me,
Guldraven has been summoned here to partake of the feast Miriam has prepared. Ramad nodded again, and this time, Chayda gave him some credit. He stared her directly in the eye.
Yes, which is why I've come to warn you and to do what I can to prevent it.
Suddenly the crowd around them swept back into Chayda's awareness. Emre was charging headlong for Ramad, who must have been as caught up as Chayda was, because he hardly reacted before Emre's fist caught him across the jaw. He went down, and then Emre was on top of him, pummeling his face over and over. Frail Lamai was nearby, shouting with boyish glee,
"Get him, Emre! Cut him! Bleed him!"
Chayda grabbed Emre's arm, holding back another undefended swing.
"Enough!"
Emre ignored her and managed to get in a couple more punches with his left hand before Chayda dragged him off Ramad's limp form.
"He gave you up to that thing!"
Emre shouted when he'd regained his feet.
"I know, Emre. So it's up to me what we do with him." "No!"
He drew his kenshar.
"He sacrificed you, as if you were his to give up."
He made for Ramad again, but Chayda stepped between them, her hands on his chest. Emre stopped, looking as frustrated as she'd ever seen him. Chayda spoke slowly and only to Emre.
"If what he said is true, the Arek is on its way. We have precious little time to decide what to do. I'm not his property, Emre, but I'm not yours either."
Emre deflated before her and was clearly embarrassed, but Chayda didn't care.
"He is mine to deal with," she continued, "not yours. Do you understand?"
Emre blinked. After a deep breath, he seemed to relax, though not much. He motioned to Ramad, who was now rolling to his feet.
"Then deal with him."
Only when Emre had sheathed his knife and stepped back did Chayda turn to face Ramad.
"Is that everything?"
"Yes, but..."
"Good," Chayda said, and slapped him. Not as hard as she could have, but enough for him to remember it.
"You've warned me of the dangers we now face, and I let you walk away only because it may save the lives of some of my tribe. But if I lay eyes on you again, Ramad Amansir, we will cross blades, and it won't end until your blood feeds the Great Mother. Do you understand?"
Ramad looked as though he wanted to say more, but when he looked around at the cold faces surrounding him, he nodded soberly and walked away. Brahma watched him go.
"You're making a mistake," he said. "We need him."
Despite everything she had just learned, she wished there was a way Ramad could stay. She felt some of the same feelings for him as she had had since first meeting him. But how foolish would it be for her to allow it? His loyalties were to Chimer. She couldn't trust him not to betray her or the tribe again.
"I don't need Ramad," she said to Brahma, "nor anyone like him."
The look that Brahma gave her was inscrutable. He was disappointed, perhaps, or angry, or both. Without another word, he followed Ramad.
Chapter 60. A terrible sense of foreboding spread among the gathering as Ramad and Brahma left. Ishak and Masid and Shalalara all began talking heatedly, but Chayda could hardly think. She looked upon those gathered, upon the ships lit by the firelight. This was her tribe. These were her people. She had hardly come to know them, and now they might be swept away like grains of sand, never to be seen again.
"How could you have led us to this, Nalame? How could you have abandoned us?"
It was then that she felt something stir. An awareness inside her grew, indistinct at first, but slowly she realized it was emanating from the bracelet on her right wrist. There was sorrow still, as there had been before, but there was something else. a glimmer along the horizon. Why, though? And why now? At the far edge of the circle, the crowd parted, and a column of women and men, led by Salsana, came to the center of the gathering. Leora walked by Salsana's side, holding not her cane, but Nalame's staff.
I would speak, Salsana said.
She stood resigned, even hopeful. The other men and women standing in the column behind her had the same stance, as if they were preparing for something momentous. Salsana faced Cheda.
I found the purpose of the bracelet.
She motioned to Cheda's wrist.
I know how we can free them.
She meant the souls of the Aesir trapped within.
Go on,
Cheda said.
At first, I thought we might release the souls in the bracelet, as Misut did in your battle with him. But neither of us have been able to, and I fear it was a gift the gods gave only him. Then I thought, perhaps we can be transformed, as you saw happen to the woman in Eventide, who was forced from her own body that Nasir might be remade. You told me King Misut transferred the Aesir's soul, but that beforehand King Cahil prepared her.
He did. Something was twisting over and over again inside Cheda's gut. She didn't at all like where this was headed.
I thought as you did, that Cahil merely prepared her body to accept another soul. I thought we would need to make our bodies ready, that the Aesirim might share our physical forms.
Salsana motioned to the site of the battle.
I felt the moment when Karim died today. I was bonded to him, and it made me realize what must be done for the Aesirim in Misut's cursed stone to be freed.
With sudden clarity, Cheda understood what Salsana meant to do, and why she had brought so many to the fire.
We cannot share this mortal coil, Salsana went on, but a single soul may fill a body. We must make way that the Aesirim might live, that they might protect us.
She turned, her gaze taking in all those behind her.
We are here for that purpose. We have come that you, Chedimin Ayn Eshala, might lead them once we are gone.
Tears came unbidden to Cheda's eyes. She blinked to clear them.
You mean to die that the Aesirim might live?
Salsana nodded.
We will pass to the Father Fields, and those whose lives were taken through no fault of their own might live once more. We will pass to give them one last chance at revenge, and that our tribe might survive the coming day.
A surge of protests rose all around the fire, pleading for Ishak to deny Salsana's request. But Salsana never took her eyes from Cheda's. She strode forward, Leora's hand in hers.
It must be so.
Her voice carried above the growing fervor.
And you must do it.
The protests grew louder. The Aesirim were feared in every corner of the desert, and rightly so. They were the king's servants, and if such a transformation could even be accomplished, the newly made Aesirim might be beholden to the kings. They would have given up lives for nothing. Worse, to give the kings fresh weapons.
What of it?
Ishak asked.
Why should we believe that these Aesirim would fight for us and not the kings?
All eyes turned to Cheda. Moths fluttered in her chest as she struggled to find the right words.
We've seen it already in Karim. An Aesir not only willing to fight for us, but die to protect us.
The first Aesir made from that bracelet in Eventide was forced into a new form by Kings Cahil and Misut. Neither the woman who died in that ritual, nor the Aesir who took her form, wished for it.
I believe it poisoned them, and kept them beholden to the will of the kings. It may be that the souls in that bracelet, when given new life, will still live beneath the yoke of the kings. But if so,
We will know it and we can stop the ritual. And remember when they were summoned on the night of endless swords and I managed to give them free will, they stormed over Misut. They took their revenge against him and ended his life. I tell you, they want more. I say we give them that chance.
The arguments broke out again.
Ishak was calling for order. Maseed and Emre and Frail Lamai were pushing some back, making room for the elders to speak. Salsana, ignoring them all, took Cheda's right wrist and held it tenderly.
You must do this, Cheda.
The raised voices became a riot of shouts. All around her were worried faces, even angry.
Enough!
Cheda called. But they didn't listen. Not until Ishak held up his hands and joined her. Slowly the noise subsided. Cheda thought Ishak would reject Salsana's request out of hand, but to her surprise, he waved one hand to her.
Speak, Chedamin.
Cheda took in the crowd anew. The moths inside her were gone, replaced by cold determination. A grim day lies ahead, she began. We've all taken a strange path. Wherever your family's tales have led you, they bear two things in common. They began on the night of Bet Iman, and they all led you here. She held the golden band high and turned it so that all could see the dark stone. This was once King Misut's. I cut it from his wrist. I watched him die as the souls trapped within used their brief freedom to tear the skin from his bones. They are trapped still, but Salsana has found a way to free them, and she and the others gathered here are willing to sacrifice their lives so these unfortunate souls, your own forebears, might release their rage against the kings. Do any here think she would say this lightly?
The gathering was silent.
Would you die for your tribe? Cheda asked them.
A long moment passed. The fire played across their grim faces. No one replied until...
I would die.
It was Emre, with the most serious expression she had ever seen on his face.
I would die for my tribe,
he repeated.
Behind Emre, the looming form of Frail Lamai stepped forward.
I would die beside him. I would die as well, said a deep voice.
Everyone turned. Maseed had spoken, and it was tacit approval of what she and Salsana were planning to do.
Would you die that your tribe might live? Cheda asked again.
We would.
The reply had become a refrain. It had come not only from Emre, Frail Lamai and Maseed, but several others in the crowd.
Would you die that the name of Kianat might be heard across the desert?
We would!
This time many more joined in.
Would you die that your children might sail where they want, free beneath the sun?
We would!
Nearly everyone had now joined the chorus. She removed the golden band from her wrist and held it against the starry night sky.
When the sun rises, we do not go to die, we go to live. That is what Salsana offers us. That is what the Asirim, trapped for so long, will deliver. They offer us life. Let us take it and use it against the kings.
Cheda paced before them.
They come for us on their galleons. They come for us with ebon steel. They come for us, their spear tipped with silver and savagery and spite. For centuries have we feared them, but tomorrow the tide will turn. They will know the name of fear. They will hear our voices raised in freedom, and they will never forget the name of Kianat. As one, they threw their hands into the air and shouted, Kianat! Kianat!
Everyone was caught by it. Maseed, Dadzada, Shalalara, Frail Lamai, Emre. Instead of looking at her with worry, always so much worry, watched her with pride. Even Hamid seemed filled with purpose, all because of her. Sumer did not shout with the others, but there was surprise in her eyes, as if she hadn't expected this from Cheda. Ishaq watched with clear pride, which somehow made Cheda keenly aware of herself, and she had to look away lest she lose her nerve.
"Go, my kinsmen," Cheda called to them, "and prepare for war."
A great roar rose from the gathering, and the crowd began to break apart at the edges. There were only a few hours left to make final preparations. The wind was starting to come to life, and more would likely come with the rising sun. They needed to be ready to sail. Cheda wanted to speak with Emre, but he was already deep in conversation with Ishaq, Masid, and Shalalara. It was clear that Ishaq had come around to her way of thinking. For better or worse, they would attack Onur's camp with their fleetest ships and hope to slay him. If they could do that, they might gain help from the tribes Onur had strong-armed to fight beneath his banner. Meanwhile, a larger contingent, led by Masid and Emre, would go after the kings, hoping to slow them down long enough for Cheda and the others to succeed. Her heart sinking just a little bit, she let them be, and left with Salsana, Leora, and all those who had volunteered. She'd not gone 10 steps into the darkness, however, when she felt a tug on her hand. She turned to see Emre.
"Go on," Cheda told Salsana. "I'll be along shortly."
Salsana nodded and led Leora across the sand. For a time, Emre and Cheda merely held hands, neither sure what to say.
"I always thought it would be easier," he finally said.
She knew what he meant. The kings, their downfall.
"At least we're still alive."
His dark eyes twinkled as he shrugged.
"We'll live to see the sunrise. That's no small thing in the desert."
An uncomfortable silence followed. Cheda wanted to ask Emre to join her. She wanted to abandon her plans to make for Onur like an arrow when the sun rose. She wanted to be with him, but she knew she couldn't. He seemed to sense it as well.
"Whatever happens," he said, "we've done this much. Whatever happens, the kings will fall."
"You're underestimating their resourcefulness."
"No, I'm not. The mountain has been chipped away at the base. Nothing will stop it from crumbling now. That's thanks to you, Cheda. You did that."
"It wasn't me."
He went on as if she hadn't spoken.
"I should never have doubted you. I should have stopped trying to protect you a long time ago."
This is what he had come to say, she realized. She kissed his neck, then held his face in both her hands and kissed him full on the lips. He warmed to it, and when he kissed her back, really kissed her, time froze for a moment. She felt the desert wind cool on her skin, heard the soft jingle of rigging, felt the sand shift beneath her feet while their lips shared stories. At last she pulled away.
"Time marches on, Emre. We must, too."
"I know."
He jutted his chin toward the fire.
"What you did back there. What you're about to do. It's what they needed. What we all needed."
She felt tears coming to her eyes.
"I should go." If she didn't, she wasn't sure she could leave his side.
"Not yet,"
he said, reaching into a pouch at his belt.
"I have something for you."
He retrieved a small metal flask, no larger than a walnut, and held it out to her.
"What is it?"
He unscrewed the top and tipped the flask toward her. It was a clear liquid that glowed a faint blue.
"Emre, what is it?"
"It's one of the elixirs that were hidden away in Eventide."
"You said they were all destroyed."
That roguish grin of his broke across his face.
One of them must have slipped into my pouch.
He screwed the cap back on and offered it to her again. She was already shaking her head.
No, Emre. You're always saving me, Chayda. Let me do something for you.
No. Whatever I do, it will fail unless you succeed. Take it with you, knowing your mission against Kiral has a better chance of succeeding.
Chayda, I won't take it, Emre.
She started backing away. He looked crestfallen, but not as much as she would have guessed.
Mule.
She couldn't help it. She smiled.
Ass. I'll go, but the price is another kiss.
You don't want one from your precious Haddad.
Emre's head jerked back.
Haddad? Surprised you noticed her.
Breath of the desert, Emre. She's pretty enough for everyone to have noticed her.
She is, but a rough stone compared to you.
It was a terrible attempt at flattery, but it warmed her heart like nothing had in many months. She swept forward and kissed him again, more passionately than before. When she broke away, his smile was broad as the sunrise.
Well then, I'll have another when I see you again.
Oh, you will you?
He smiled his old smile, the one that made her melt.
See if I don't.
A sigh escaped her as he jogged across the sand. She didn't wish for them to part, but it had been the perfect time to see him. How better to bolster her heart before the dark, terrible business ahead? She rejoined Leora and the others, who had found a place along the top of a dune near the center of their fleet. In the hour that followed, Chayda spoke to each of the volunteers in turn. She learned their names and their stories. 17 souls, the same number as those within the bracelet. She was constantly aware of the jet stone. She listened to the souls within, felt them stir as a man told of his time in the northern reaches of the desert, and another spoke of working as a shipwright. With Selsana she took particular care. As the daughter of a weaver and a hunter, as a girl who took to both swords and music at an early age, who was later introduced to Leora and became fascinated with stories of the 13th tribe, Salsana's story summoned the strongest of the souls within the stone and by far the most violent.
Salsana's sacrifice will grant you life, Chayda whispered to it. Remember her. And let your enemies quake.
The wind, as many had predicted, began to lift with the coming dawn. The tribe gathered in a circle. All around the ships had been prepared. A bell began to ring, warning that Onor's ships were on the move. It was quickly silenced by Ishak as the 13th tribe gathered around Chayda and the Forsaken, as they had already been dubbed. They wore no sandals, nor any other adornment. Each was wrapped in white gauze to help their passage to the farther fields. Leora had painted ancient symbols over their faces and along their palms. Save for the flush in their skin, they already looked like the gathering of whites that had risen from Mesut's stone on the night of endless swords. With Leora by her side, Chayda moved to the first. Farrell, a woman no older than Chayda, with bright brown eyes and rose petal lips. She was breathing so quickly, Chayda thought she might lose heart.
You are the light that guides us, Chayda said to her, then kissed her forehead.
The woman heartened, squeezed Chayda's hands, and tipped her head back, and with that, Chayda summoned the first of the souls. As she had on the night of endless swords, she opened her heart wide and gave herself to them. Slowly the soul came forth. The amethyst on Leora's right hand shone like a beacon as she helped to guide it. Farrell gasped, a moan escaped her, one filled with pain and sorrow. And then, like the quieting of a winter breeze, Chayda felt Farrell's soul depart. Her skin turned ashen. Her eyes fluttered as the color in her eyes turned to ice. In her place stood another. Chayda could see it in the intensity of her eyes, which had been cast anew. That unchained soul stared about the circle. Her nostrils flared. Her lips drew back to reveal a row of perfect teeth. Everything about her spoke of the desire to fly over the desert, to expend her rage upon her enemies. Chayda moved to the next in the circle. Staven, a stout man with a misshapen face and a bulbous nose.
You are the light that guides us, Chayda said, and kissed his forehead.
He did not stare at the sky as his soul departed, but at Chayda, his impotent fury plain to see. The Aesir that filled his form kept that intensity, but the mood had changed. He was a vessel filled with power, trapped lightning, ready to be unleashed. One by one, Chayda and Leora walked along the circle, and one by one, an Aesir took the form of the man or woman before her, until only Salsana remained. Chayda wanted to spare her. She had hardly come to know this valiant woman, and now she was leaving. But to question her would be to insult her gravely. So she nodded, and Salsana nodded back.
Go well, Chayda said to her. May we meet again, Salsana replied.
Chayda guided the last, and Salsana departed these shores. In her place stood someone who sent a chill along Chayda's spine. The other Aesirim held power, but this one held more. Like Sahid Alaz, like Kerim, like Hava, she was so intense she burned from within. Chayda heard a crack, like the breaking of fine porcelain. She looked down and saw the jet stone had broken down the middle. As she watched, another fissure appeared, and another. Dark fragments breaking away and falling to the amber sand until none remained in the bracelet's artful setting. As Chayda removed the bracelet and tossed it among the black fragments, the sun crested the horizon. It shone bright and beautiful upon all those gathered. Chayda thought the Forsaken would be bent as the Aesirim, but they weren't. They stood tall, holy avengers, unsullied by the taint of the Sharakani kings. All those gathered stared in awe, and no one appeared ready to speak, as if doing so might change their nature, might bend their backs and turn them into the servants of the kings once more. When another bell rang, the spell was broken.
The king's ships are moving, the lookout called.
The wind was strong and growing stronger.
Battle is upon us, Ishak called.
The 13th tribe obeyed and spread to their assigned ships. Chayda was about to move toward hers when she saw how bent Leora was, how weak.
Come, grandmother, Chayda said. You and your sister have done well.
Leora looked up with surprise in her eyes.
You know?
I suspected ever since Salsana told me the story of Devorah. As I feel the Aesirim, I felt Devorah within the amethyst, though at first I didn't recognize it as such. Once I did, I began to sense changes at dusk and dawn, when your souls shift between body and stone.
Chayda gripped Leora's right hand, the one with the great amethyst ring.
It's how you were able to help shepherd the Forsaken into their new forms, yes?
Leora nodded, her eyes suddenly misty.
I'm glad you know, child.
I am too, Chayda replied. I feel both of you now, lending one another strength. She's carried you for some time, but she doesn't do so alone. I'll help as I can.
Very well, child.
Leora smiled a grandmother's smile and motioned to her yacht.
Come with me. I fight in me yet.
Me too, Chayda thought, and led her onward. Chapter 61 The autumn rose sailed the morning sand. Sheikh Ariz's crew was tense but ready. None of the grim determination they'd shown by the fireside had diminished. If anything, it seemed more intense.